This is the phenomena of creationism. This is the phenomena of dominionism, or the ideology that is being foisted upon this country by the radical Christian white. I, of course, don't give this movement religious legitimacy, however earnest, however well-meaning and decent many of the followers are, because I look at them as being manipulated by very callous, cold, and sophisticated demagogues like James Dobson, who have figured out that by manipulating people's despair, they can not only get rich, but they can get powerful. And I think that it's important for those of us who care about our open society and who want to fight to protect our democracy that we make this distinction between those people who are being used by this movement and those figures at the top of the movement like Pat Robertson, who have tapped into this despair, understood it, and used it for deeply nefarious and dark ends. All of you should take time to listen to Christian radio and broadcasting. It's deeply disturbing. The ideology it promotes is one in which people like me have no place in this society. One of the arguments, and I think you see it within segments of the Democratic Party, is that there should be an effort to reach out to this movement and engage in a dialogue with it, to try and bring evangelicals, of which there are 80 to 100 million in this country, back into the Democratic fold. I think this is a disastrous mistake for this reason. When you deal with a movement whose leaders preach that there are only two acceptable ways of being, either conversion, which of course means submission to their authority and their ideological belief system, or extinction, because that is what they're saying, then there is no room for a dialogue. All dialogue must include mutual respect, the recognition that there are other ways to be, other ways to believe, other faiths that have validity, including faiths outside the nation. When that mutual respect is abolished, when the discussion between you and an adversary is only about your submission, or ultimately, of course, eradication in this obsession with apocalyptic violence, which really is a manifestation of the kind of rage that many of these people feel, this theology of despair, because that's what this is. It's not, which should be the heart of the Christian gospel, it's not a theology of hope or love. It's a theology which says nothing in this world is worth saving and worth protecting, and therefore everything should be destroyed, including all of those people on the planet that have not bought into my belief system. And the language, and some of it's in the book, of the many of the people, like Rod Parsley is a good example, is one that's constantly filled with the language of violence and the language of war. And I think that when you look at like the Left Behind series or any of the long descriptions of what happens at the end times, there's a deep pornographic quality to the violence that is poured out. And of course, what happens in totalitarian systems is that you surrender your conscience. Moral decisions are made for you. You are told what is right, what is wrong. That's part of the attractiveness of totalitarian movements. You remove that anxiety, and you are given a moral license by demagogues to hate and to destroy certain segments. You can direct that rage and hatred and kill with a free conscience. And you see it the way they talk about Muslims. And there's also, I went to a weekend with Tim LaHaye in Detroit, and which, you know, they brand the religion of Islam as satanic, as something that must be abolished from the face of the earth. And that binary worldview, that ability to hand to believers the right to kill, is one that's deeply intoxicating, and of course is one of the attractiveness not only of this movement, but of all despotic or totalitarian movements. It was one of the things that I saw Slobodan Milosevic use to great effectiveness in with crowds in Belgrade. So how does one handle a movement like this? How does one deal as we watch this movement rise within our society? There's a. I'm going to read just one little more passage from Karl Popper, who writes about this in his book, The Open Society and Its Enemies. Popper himself, like Hannah Arendt, like Fritz Stern, he was Popper was Viennese. He fled during the Second World War and wrote, you know, not only this great sort of scholarly work, but like Arendt, combined with the passion of somebody who understood how these movements work in a very visceral way, and of course suffered. Many of his own family members were killed in the Holocaust. He writes about tolerance, and Popper has this wonderful term. He calls it the paradox of tolerance. He says, unlimited tolerance must lead to the disappearance of tolerance. If we extend unlimited tolerance, even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. In this formulation, I do not imply, for instance, that we should always suppress the utterance of intolerant philosophies as long as we can counter them by rational argument and keep them in check by public opinion. Suppression would certainly be most unwise. But we should claim the right to suppress them, if necessary, even by force, for it may easily turn out that they are not prepared to meet us on the level of rational argument, but begin by denouncing all argument. They may forbid their followers to listen to rational argument because it is deceptive, and teach them to answer arguments by the use of their fists or pistols. We should therefore claim in the name of tolerance the right not to tolerate the intolerant. We should claim that any movement preaching intolerance places itself outside the law, and we should consider incitement to intolerance and persecution as criminal, in the same way as we should consider incitement to murder or to kidnapping or to the revival of the slave trade as criminal. And so what do we do? If I'm correct, if the root of this movement lies in the dislocation or disenfranchisement of tens of millions of Americans, the physical destruction of community, and when one looks at the two epicenters of the movement, it comes from these blighted former manufacturing centers and these huge soulless exurbs like Orange County, where there's no community center, no community rituals, often no sidewalks. And people live in vast, palladium-windowed monstrosities and get in big, empty cars and drive 2 hours to big, empty offices in L.A. and come home again. I think that physical destruction of community and the despair that it engenders, often economic, but not always, have been the engines of this movement. And unfortunately, there's no check now on the growth of America's oligarchy. We currently live in a country where the top 1% control more wealth than the 90% of households combined. And democracies cannot survive with these kinds of disparities and inequities. And that's not a new thought. Plutarch wrote about it. Thucydides wrote about it. We must find a way to reincorporate these people back into American society, to give them hope. If they continue to live on the margins of American society, if we continue to allow the assaults on the American working class to now reach out to the American professional class, and of course anything that can be put on software today can be outsourced, which means that engineering, architecture, a host of technical fields can be handed off to professional sweatshops in India where workers will work without benefits and, of course, at a third of the wages of American society. Unless we begin to stand up against these forces, then I think there is finally no way to blunt this movement. There are certainly things that we can do, passing hate crimes legislation. Look at everything they're fighting against. They are working very hard to make it impossible to have hate crimes legislation as we have in Canada, because they know that it can be applied to them in the kind of filth that they spew over the radio and broadcasting about a host of American citizens, starting with gays and lesbians. You know, one of the things Adams told us when I was in seminary was that we should watch very closely to what this movement did towards gays and lesbians. Because the first decree that Hitler passed in 1933, after he took power at the end of January, was banning all gay and lesbian meeting places. And one of the first book burnings that he carried out was in May at the Berlin Sexual Institute. And this drive to clean up the filth of Weimar Germany, to restore moral order, to bring back traditional German values, were lauded and cheered not only by the majority of the German public, but by the German churches as well. And Adams said that that process of stripping citizens of their rights because of their sexual orientation, of singling out social deviants, people labeled as social deviants, was part of the march towards our door, because they have a long list of social deviants. And we would be very naive to believe that they intend to stop with gays and lesbians, because when they're finished with them, they will turn on women, on scholars, on artists, on scientists. There is a host of people that they are ready to destroy. And so for me, that battle, and unfortunately it's a battle we're losing, to protect the rights of gays and lesbians in this country is that canary in the cage, that tocsin bell that should be ringing and warning all of us that when they finish with them, they're going to come through the door for us. So I believe that while hate crimes legislation is important, while efforts to challenge the use of airwaves to funnel messages of hatred and violence is something that should be campaigned against within the society, finally, we will only break this movement by reaching out, as we did in the 1930s, to millions of Americans who were dispossessed and bringing them back into our society. That, of course, is the great gift of the New Deal. It saved us from American corporatism, which, of course, corporatism is a term that comes from Mussolini's fascist state. It's why Fortune magazine in 1934 put Mussolini on its cover and praised him for the empowerment of Italian industrialists at the expense of Italian workers, and it's why there was a huge flirtation in the 1930s with fascism by American conservatives and American corporate interests. And of course, what we have seen, and Robert O. Paxton writes about this in his book, Anatomy of Fascism. He says there is no such thing as a purely fascist movement, unlike communism. Fascists always make uneasy alliances with conservative or corporate interests. And that's precisely what the Christian right has done. It's why Tyson Foods or DeVore's or many of these groups that have been gathered together by people like Tim LaHaye are so willing to fund this movement. Because if you remove people from a reality-based world, it's so much easier to rape them and take away absolutely everything they have in their life that can protect them. Because, of course, what's held up in front of them is this mirage that God is going to save them. And I think that that alliance has now gone extremely far and become extremely effective and a very potent and dangerous political force in American society. Finally, let me conclude by saying that none of these movements can come to power unless there is a prolonged period of instability or crisis. And we're not in a period of crisis now. But should we suffer another catastrophic terrorist attack? Should we have an economic meltdown? Should we suffer a series of environmental disasters? Then I think these groups stand poised to manipulate our fear, promise us security, safety, and protection, of course, if we will turn over their rights and move to reshape American society in ways that have probably not been seen since our nation's founding. Thank you very much. He's asking, how can these groups deal with or counter Jesus' message about the poor, about rendering unto Caesar the things that are Caesar, Jesus constantly inveighed against violence, the use of violence. I think that one of the things that gives me a kind of window into the movement is, because I know the Bible so well, I'm a little more attuned to how they distort it. And when you watch how they distort it and what parts of the Bible they pick out and what parts they ignore, because there are certainly hateful messages in the Bible. There are passages in the Hebrew Bible where God appears to countenance, even bless genocide. The Gospel of John has anti-Semitic statements in it. Paul denounces homosexuality, also promotes slavery as an institution. But it's what they ignore and what they pick out that exposes who they are. And that gross misuse of the Bible is such, I'm just going to give a little example to show that in a minute. That gross misuse is a huge tip-off as to what it is they're trying to promote. When you know the Bible and you know you know how they edit it to fit their ideology. I mean, they often talk about acculturating America to the Christian religion, but a fact, of course, the opposite has happened. They have acculturated the Christian religion with the worst of American imperialism and American capitalism. And that distortion of the Bible, for me, essentially means they're heretics. I look at them as heretics. You know, it is just absolutely inconceivable that one can read through the Greek Bible and believe that God wants us all to have huge cars and Learjets and lots of money. It's absolutely inconceivable. And so they present themselves as literalists, but of course they're not literalists. They're selective literalists. Do they believe, as it says in the Hebrew Bible, that the vault of night sky above us are all the little lights are peepholes with God looking down on us? I mean, there's so much stuff in the Bible that is so fantastic that they discard. And there are so many passages, like the Sermon on the Mount, that they have no use for, that it becomes very clear that they're about something else. I attended a creation seminar run by these ideologues to teach teachers in Christian schools how to teach about creation. And I think it's in the details that the irrationality of their belief system becomes apparent. Because, of course, what happens in Genesis is that God creates light on the first day and the sun on the fourth day. And so how the instructor was having to deal with this tricky question of what that meant. And he said, well, God created a temporary light. Well, there's nothing in Genesis that even hints that God created a temporary light. If everything was created in 6 days, I went to the Creation Museum in Peterborough, Kentucky, this $25 million museum, where they have a replication of the Garden of Eden with dinosaurs. Because dinosaurs were in the garden, you put saddles on them and ride them and stuff like this. And questions like, how did Noah get the dinosaurs on the ark? Well, Noah got them on the ark because they were baby dinosaurs. And why is it that T-Rex, because the dinosaurs and man, before the fall, dinosaurs were just plant eaters because everything was peaceful, but why did T-Rex have such big teeth? If he just ate plants, well, he had big teeth because he would crack open the coconuts with the teeth.
So just a quick follow-up. Do we need a reformation, and how would you like to lead it?
Do we need a reformation? I think we need the liberal church to get some spine and stand up. And I think we have to stop giving these people religious legitimacy and start denouncing them for the messages of hate that they wrap in the American flag and the Christian gospel. Right. Where does the Catholic Church fall in that? That's a really interesting question, you know, because I would go to these events, and this, of course, I think is endemic of what's happened in the movement, and you would see Catholic priests from Priests for Life and uniformed members of the Salvation Army and charismatics and Baptists all together in the same room. Now, you know, fundamentalists, many fundamentalists traditionally look at charismatics as Satan worshippers because they speak in tongues. I mean, the doctrinal disputes are not small. You know, the anti-Catholicism, along with the anti-Semitism, along with the racism, was, you know, still runs deep within conservative Christian circles. But what they've managed to do is unite these groups around this project of creating a Christian America, so that these doctrinal or schismatic differences remain. But for now, they've been put on hold. Certainly, if they ever took power, you know, if these radical dominionists took power, I don't think they'd have much time for the Catholic Church. Even when I took that seminar with D. James Kennedy, he referred to the Catholic Church as a cult, privately in the room. So they've drawn these conservative elements of the Catholic Church, you know, along with charismatics, along with Pentecost, into the embrace of this movement to create a Christian America. But those differences remain. They remain virulent. They remain strong. And when you look at all radical movements, that's not uncommon. You know, go back and read the Russian Revolution. I mean, what happens is that once these forces achieve power, the most ruthless and the most vicious are the ones who rise up to the top. That's how Lenin got to where he was. And oftentimes they spend more time killing off their own than they do killing off anyone else, because it is that scramble for power. Crane Britton wrote a lot about this in a great book, The Anatomy of a Revolution. The Christian right in Iraq. Well, you know, what's happened in this country is, and this is unfortunately been mainstreamed for us by the Christian right, is that we speak about Muslims in a way that I think we could not speak about any other minority or ethnic group in this country. I spent 7 years in the Middle East. I spent 600 hours of my life studying Arabic. I mean, you know, Islam or the Muslim world constitute one-fifth of the world's population, most of whom, by the way, are not Arab. And the statements of ignorance and racism that are routinely put out against Muslims are ones that I think are very much fueled by the Christian right, which has demonized Islam and to our own detriment. You know, what radical movements do, just as radical Islamists, I mean, the radical Islamists, of course, are in many ways the mirror image of the Christian right. What they do is destroy the moderate center of their own societies. And the Christian right is working as hard to destroy the moderate center of our society, just as Islamic radicals are working hard to destroy the moderate center of their society, which is the majority, by the way, the vast majority. I mean, I lived in Egypt. I lived 7 years and traveled all throughout the Middle East. And what you're left with, which is what happened in the Balkans, are these two apocalyptic extremes who need each other. You know, Milosevic needed Tudjman, and Tudjman needed Milosevic. You know, one of the most interesting and disturbing things that we saw when we covered conflicts when they began is that the first people to be killed were not the radical members of the opposing ethnic group, because they need them. They need them to instill fear within their own, within your ethnic group. They were the members within your ethnic group who still reached out to the Muslims in the community, who still went over and had coffee with them, who still would visit the imam in the mosque. They were the first people to end up with a bullet through their head in the ditch, because they showed people another way to be, another way to speak, and another way to act, a way to hold together community. Those are the first people that get destroyed, and they get destroyed by their own.
Is there a fatwa from the Christian right on you now?
Not yet. I think that you know, the fringe element of this movement is frightening, and I think part of the reason people are hesitant to speak out about them is because people who come out of Christian Identity, Operation Rescue, and let's not forget about Blackwater and Eric Prince, the creation of America's Praetorian Guard, which is underway in Iraq right now, 25,000 American mercenaries. Eric Prince is a charter member of the radical Christian right, secretive, multimillionaire figure. What happened when Hurricane Katrina struck? Blackwater figures in black uniforms with automatic weapons and wraparound sunglasses showed up on the streets of New Orleans. What happens when there's a catastrophic terrorist attack in Washington and they throw this Praetorian Guard on the streets of Washington? Not accountable to anyone, outside of legal constraints. Look at what Christian Embassy is doing and other radical Christian groups are doing in the Pentagon. They're taking over all the chaplaincies. At least 50% now have fealty to non-denominational figures within the Christian right, and that's a form of indoctrination. It's a way of preaching to the military that their loyalty is to this Christo-fascist ideology and not to the democratic state. And in a moment of crisis, you know, when I travel to these mega churches, they are completely isolated from the community that they exist in. They don't reach out to other denominations. They don't reach out to the public schools. They could care less about the local officials. The only two groups they ever reach out to are law enforcement and the military. And that was a pattern that I kept seeing repeated in megachurch after megachurch after megachurch. U.S. Marine Corps Appreciation Day, State Trooper Sunday. And they would bring these people in and laud them for their Christian probity. And they know very well what they're doing. That those forces of coercion within a society are absolutely fundamental if any radical movement is going to succeed. Thank you.
That was Chris Hedges on American Fascists, the Radical Christian Right. He spoke at the Boulder Bookstore in Boulder, Colorado on January 22, 2007. Chris Hedges, a veteran foreign correspondent, is the author of American Fascists, the Christian Right and the War on America. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. AR features such voices as Bill Moyers, Howard Zinn, George Lakoff, Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, and Gore Vidal. To access our vast audio catalog and to find out about subscribing to AR, go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, tape, or written transcript of the program you just heard, Chris Hedges on American Fascists, call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.